Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening this morning. The topic in this first hour of Focus is children's health, and it's something that we do every month, always on a Thursday. We built the program into the schedule to give you a regular and predictable opportunity to ask these kinds of questions. And our guest, Dr. Robert Bochak, he's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic. And he's here with us on a monthly basis to talk with you. If you have questions, can be the usual sort of health sorts of things, can be development issues, can be behavioral, can be whatever you could imagine talking about with a pediatrician. You can call in here and talk with him, and I know he will do his best to help you out. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
I think on a recent program, maybe it was the last time we were talking about the fact that there was a shortage of vaccine for one of the things that was required for kids who are going back to school. And I think, and now I've read some recently on this, and I guess what parents are being told is, we're going to get the vaccine, and when we get it, we'll give the kids the shots. So send them back to school, and when we can, we'll do that. But now there seems to be some, I don't know, discussion about, well, who exactly is responsible for making sure the kids get their shots? Is it the school's responsibility? Is it the parents' responsibility? And are we going to end up having to be chasing parents down and saying, hey, by the way, you know, the kids are supposed to get these shots?
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. That's going to be a mess, because it's thought that the vaccine shortage, the tetanus toxoid shortage, will be not fixed till 2002. So next year, we've got to play catch-up with all the kids that we missed this year, plus the ninth graders for next year. And we're keeping a list at our office. Hopefully most offices are and will notify parents, but you know, I think there's going to be some that probably sneak through. I don't know how. It's going to be a mess. It's going to be a mess. And I think this is an important vaccine. This does protect against diphtheria and tetanus or lockjaw. And for you adults out there, this is supposed to be done every 10 years. You need a booster. And I think there's a lot of adults out there that probably can't remember the last time they had their booster. So, you know, while we're talking about this, you parents and adults think about this too, because these are diseases that still exist. Fortunately, we don't see them, but they still exist, and we don't see them because of the vaccine. But adults, check your immunization schedule too to make sure you've got it, that you're updated there. We do have adequate vaccine for those who get a tetanus-prone injury. And we've given it to a couple of kids in our office this last week who had dirty wounds that we thought needed. So it's not that we're completely out of it. It's just that we're reserving the supplies we do have for those who appear to be in real need.
Okay. So you would say, hope that parents will make a note to themselves, something like this, and will at least keep in mind that the kids do need to get it,
yeah,
and that they should maybe check with their pediatrician, or just be aware of the fact that they need to get it, and at some point the vaccine is going to be widely available. There's going to be no problem, and that they need to kind of stay on top of it.
One company, I think there's only one company currently making it, and they're gearing up, but apparently it takes 11 months to gear up to produce the vaccine, so it's going to be a while yet.
That's in a way that seems kind of surprising to me, that something that would be so widely given, would only one company on all of the United States makes this vaccine?
Well, there used to be four or five, but the story I got, and I'm not sure if this is exactly true or not, that it became non-profitable. Or they had, one company said they had to, the FDA said, your facility is no longer satisfactory. You need to put X number of dollars into upgrading this facility. And the company said, it's not profitable enough.
So we're just not going to make it anymore.
We're just not going to do it.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Let's talk with them on a cell phone. Line number one. Hello?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the tetanus vaccine. So it's not possible to get it until next year, because I'm coming up on my I'm coming up on 7 years since my last booster, I think, and I usually like to do them a little bit in advance.
Okay. It won't be till next year. I probably wouldn't do it. Every 10 years is enough. And there's some concern that if you get it too frequently, you may the chances of allergic reactions may go up.
Okay. Because last time I got it, I was at like 8 years, and I had a pretty dirty tear in my foot. And
okay.
They gave it to me. And I don't know, I just seem to end up with every within 10 years, I seem to end up with some cut or another that seems to merit something like that. But that's interesting. I didn't know about the allergic reaction. Okay, well,
no, that's true. If you have a tetanus prone wound, the rule is every 5 years. Every 10 years for routine prophylaxis. But if you have a dirty wound and you haven't had one within 5 years, we'll give it.
I haven't had one for a while, but last time I did. I tore my foot up pretty bad on a nail. I wasn't sure. So basically, none of this is available for children or adults. It's not just a children's vaccine. It's the general population can't get it.
Yeah, worries.
Well, if you need it, you get it.
If you need it, you get it. We're reserving the quantities out there. Most people are reserving the quantities out there for people who need it, that is, have a tetanus-prone wound.
Sure. Okay. Great. Thanks.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let's go to Aurora for another caller. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Bocek. Nice to talk to you. I have a list that I got someplace about grandmother's rules, and I'm missing one, and my friend criticized me for suggesting to my daughter that she take my granddaughter to the doctor. And so I wanted to tell my friend what I use as a criteria to do the things to interact with my daughter, realizing that she's a parent always. So these are the things that I've written down, and I wondered if you might know what number 4 is. The first is don't criticize. The second, don't interfere. The third is the parent always has the last say. And the fifth is, will it matter in 5 years? And in this instance, I thought it would matter in 5 years. So I suggested to my daughter that she take her daughter to the doctor. And she did, and the daughter had sinusitis, which in 10 days followed with bronchitis.
Okay.
So, can you think of another thing or another rule for a grandparent?
No. I've never heard those five rules before, and I think I disagree with the first couple you've mentioned. It is a grandmother's grandparent's right to interfere. It is a grandmother's right to be a little bit neurotic, and I've had some of the most wonderful mothers who, when they got to be grandmothers, did get a bit neurotic. I agree with rule number 5, I think it was, that, you know, it's the parent's responsibility to, and I've often told parents, you know, politely listen to the grandparents. You don't have to follow through with what they recommend, but it probably would behoove you to politely listen to them. But I think it's awfully nice to have more than one or two people watching a child.
So would that be one of your things that you would suggest?
I think grandparents have a right. I think grandparents have more experience than parents do. I think grandparents have a right to have an obligation to suggest if they think that their grandchild is not functioning well, either behaviorally or health-wise or whatever. But the grandparents, again, don't have the legal guardianship, so it is up to the parents to take action. And it is up to the parents to decide if the grandparents' concerns are valid or not.
So you don't think grandparents shouldn't criticize?
Oh, no. I think grandparents have to be tactful about it too, but I think, you know, let's change the word criticize to suggest.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So we'll make it a positive instead of a negative.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Suggest.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's also the parents' right to ignore the suggestion.
Well, see, now, the one is the parent always has the last say, which is
that's
great.
Right.
The parent always does have the last say.
That's right. And then, but anybody has the right, if a child is being abused, neglected, to step, you know, to make the anonymous call to Department of Children and Family Services.
Well, this child wasn't being neglected. It
yeah.
was just a matter of...
This was a cough that was hanging on too long.
What?
This was a cough hanging on too long, or... Yeah.
Okay.
Stuffy nose hanging on too long. Yeah, this... Yeah, I think I... Yeah, the position you were in is a suggestion. The child's health wasn't that bad, it sounds like.
Oh, it was. She had tinnitus, and then...
Sinusitis, yeah.
Sinusitis, and followed by bronchitis, and was out of school for 23 days.
Okay. Wow.
So I was trying to change that situation this summer by having her healthy, so when she goes to school this fall, she has a better approach to learning, et cetera, because her grades were very poor.
Okay.
And she's a brilliant child. So.
Okay, great.
Thank you much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician from Christi Clinic in Champaign and is on the program every month, always on a Thursday, to talk with us and with you about children's health. Questions are welcome. Anything you can think of asking a pediatrician, that's fair game on this show. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Back here locally to someone in Champaign, line one.
Dr. Bocek.
Good morning.
I was wondering if my 16-year-old and my 18-year-old are still too young to take aspirin. We've always been fearing Reye syndrome when they were younger, but I don't know when that becomes safe.
You know, I can't answer that because Reye syndrome has been reported in adults.
Really?
And the other question is, where's Reye syndrome gone? Because we don't see it anymore. It's disappeared. The other thing I will say is, was aspirin ever an etiologic contributing factor to Reye syndrome? Because Reye syndrome was first reported by Dr. Reye out of Australia, an Australian pathologist. And I remember a letter to the editor in one of the pediatric journals years ago, that said more or less, you silly Americans blaming this on aspirin because we've never used aspirin in Australia. They always used acetaminophen, Tylenol there.
I grew up on aspirin.
That's right. That's right. And we had a brief flurry of Reye syndrome back when I was a resident. It was about the 1970s, early 1970s. And then the disease just disappeared again. And there's some speculation that it was a misdiagnosis, that Reye syndrome really didn't exist, that what we were diagnosing was inborn errors of metabolism in the urea cycle and that. But I'm not sure I believe that completely either. But Reye syndrome may not have been an entity by itself. It may have been a couple of other mislabeling other things. But I guess my other question is, why would you like to use aspirin when we have the ibuprofens that work just as well?
Well, I was thinking of infection, and we've always, I'm old, so it's possible that aspirin doesn't take away or doesn't heal the early-on infection that we always thought it did. But I always felt that the early symptoms of something or an infection, aspirin.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not talking about pain. I'm not talking about fever.
Okay. Because none of the aspirins, the Tylenols, the ibuprofens have any anti-infective properties at all. So all they'll do is reduce fever and reduce discomfort, reduce pain.
So it's just all old wives' tales.
Yeah, there's nothing. Yeah, there's
even
nothing.
Aspirin.
Yes.
I'll be.
And I think the only aspirin is recommended now in people with coronary artery disease. First thing you do is pop an aspirin if you think you're having a heart attack, or maybe maintain. And we're talking about baby aspirin. We're talking about 1 1/4 gram. We're talking about very small doses of aspirin. And why is this recommended? Because aspirin interferes with platelet function, with blood clotting function. to a certain, not a great extent, not a great problem. But that's what, the, you know, if you're about ready to stroke or you're about ready to have a heart attack, you're all the plate, yeah, you're about ready to clot off your coronary artery vessels, aspirin will thin the blood, if you will. It interferes with platelets. It doesn't interfere with the clotting cycle per se, but it interferes with platelets, so you're less likely to have a thrombus form. But aspirin itself has no anti-infective properties, or all it does is relieve discomfort and reduce fever.
Well, thank you for that information.
Okay.
Yes, thank you
Thanks
so much.
You're welcome.
Very good.
Bye-bye.
So let's review. A lot of over-the-counter pain relievers available. Tylenol, your acetaminophen. Well, you got a headache, that should help.
That's fine.
If you have a fever, that should do that. And again, as I understand it, the one thing that won't do, where you might want to choose something else, it doesn't have the anti-inflammatory properties that aspirin also does. So that if what you think is a strain, a sprain, joint complaint, that kind of thing, maybe muscular ache, something from overuse, a sports injury, that kind of stuff, you might want to choose the ibuprofen, because the Tylenol, while that might, have some pain-relieving properties, the anti-inflammatory stuff that you might also want to have, Tylenol won't do anything about that.
Yeah, and then the other thing that makes the situation a little murkier about choosing your pain reliever is the platelet interference. Tylenol will not interfere with platelets, which are the little tiny cells in the blood that are the initial clotters. Generally, this is of no problem. It doesn't mess up your blood clotting that much. But if you're preoperative, you want to be able to clot well. So most surgeons will say, gee, if you've got platelets have a life expectancy of about 3 days. So within a few days of surgery, you'd want to switch from aspirin or ibuprofen to Tylenol for pain relief, because you want everything working well in the operating room so you don't have post-operative bleeding and complications. And so, yeah, it gets confusing, doesn't it?
It does. Maybe one other question about acetaminophen, Tylenol. I think that there has been some concern about problems related to, or that people might get into problems if they take a lot of it.
Yes.
And so that, but I guess then my question is, well, what exactly does that mean? That should mean that it's okay if you once a month or a couple of times a month you have a headache and you take some Tylenol.
Yeah.
But how much is too much?
If you take about a tenfold over the recommended dose, so we've got a pretty good margin of safety with acetaminophen with Tylenol. But if you take over about tenfold the recommended dose, you may kill your liver. Mm. And then there's been some concern about hepatotoxicity. If you have a headache, you take Tylenol and you go have a couple of drinks, alcoholic beverages, that there may be. But I think the latest out on that is that's probably not true. It's probably still safe. But there's if you make a mistake and take twice as much Tylenol as you're supposed to, you'll be okay. Ibuprofen, probably the NSAIDs, ibuprofen is an NSAID, and that stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. NSAIDs also include, actually there's a big family of those now. I think the other common one over-the-counter goes under the name Aleve, which is naproxen. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of the NSAIDs probably over Tylenol 2, in addition to less complications possibly, is the duration of action. The naproxen you take every 12 hours. Ibuprofen you take every 6 to 8 hours. And Tylenol you take every 4 hours or so. So you get a little longer duration of action with that too.
All right. Dr. Robert Bocek is here with us. It's our monthly show on children's health. And if you have questions, you're invited to call 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. But anybody else, if it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. Next person here is in Monticello. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Bocek.
Yes.
Our daughter, about a year ago, had allergy testing done where they prick her back.
Mm-hmm.
And last month, she got a really bad-sounding cough, and the doctor, the pediatrician, said that she had croup, even though she's 9 years
old. Okay.
And then pretty soon, he said, the next time we saw him a couple weeks later, he thought it might have been allergy-induced, even though her allergy tests had come back quote-unquote negative. And
okay.
I just wondered what the point of the allergy testing is and how that is determined.
Okay. Allergy testing, what they'll do is they'll take antigens of what they suspect you're allergic to by history. So they can use grasses or molds or dog dander or cat dander and that sort of stuff. And they'll take a little bit of the androgen and they'll scratch it into the skin. And then they'll measure the amount of body inflammatory reaction, wheal and flare reaction, around the antigen that they scratched in there. And if it's big enough, you say you're probably allergic to that. The problem gets to be you have to, you know, you can't possibly scratch. There's not enough skin on somebody's back to have every antigen scratched in there. So you do it by, you pick your antigens by history. You know, your symptoms are what time of year. Okay, that means you're maybe allergic to, in the fall, ragweed is probably the most common one. In the spring, you get the trees and that sort of stuff. So you pick a few and, you know, by history and guess which one they're likely to be. And then you can make a serum out of that. And what the serum, the desensitization serum is basically the antigen in increasing doses. So you hopefully desensitize the patient to it. Croup, by and large, or croup almost 100% of the time, not entirely, but croup is a viral infection. So it's unlikely, if it was a true croupy cough, that it was allergic. It's much more likely that it was a viral infection. And yes, any age group can get croup. Probably most common in the, you know, around year to 2 years of life, but any age group can get croup.
So is there anything wrong with her being on Claritin now?
Not if she needs it. If she's having nasal symptoms and that sort of thing, itchy nose, sneezy nose, congestion and that sort of stuff, there's nothing wrong with being on Claritin.
Okay.
It's a pretty side effect free drug.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And anybody else? We're about at our midpoint here. Anybody else? You have questions? You'd like to talk with Dr. Bocek? 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. I don't want to get too controversial here, but let me ask you a question just because I know there has been some question about it, about Claritin. It's a drug that has been immensely popular, and particularly because when it first came out, it was it stood alone because it was a non-sedating antihistamine. We have a lot of antihistamines, and they work really well. The problem with them is that they make people drowsy.
Yeah.
So this was a great thing because it came along, and first of all, you could just take one little pill, and that would do you for the day. And that it didn't have the sedating properties. Now, I think more recently, some people have raised the question about this drug and say that they think it was overhyped and that, in fact, in a lot of people, it doesn't do anything. It still, I'm sure, is a very heavily prescribed drug, although now I think maybe Allegra, which is similar, is maybe more of that is prescribed. I suppose it also depends if you get your drugs from an HMO, which one they decide.
Which one, yeah.
You know, who's going to make them the best deal? Yeah. That's going to be the one that they're going to dispense. And I guess I wonder what your experience with them has been and whether, in fact, you think that pretty much they do work. But, you know, maybe it's a case that, like with a lot of drugs, some drugs work in some people and other people they don't. And we don't exactly know why. That's just kind of the way it is.
I think that last statement is what it boils down to. In some people, Claritin works great. In other people, Allegra works great. Some people like Zyrtec or Benadryl. Benadryl is a good antihistamine. It's been around forever, but that tends to sedate people. Yeah, it's tough to use. It's a good bedtime antihistamine. Because it puts them to sleep too. But yeah, Claritin, it's a good drug. It works. But like most drugs, it doesn't work in everybody. And so often what we like to do in the office is, Here's a handful of Allegra samples, or here's a handful of Claritin samples, and or here's a handful of both. See which one works better. Because, yeah, they do respond differently. I think there's sort of a feeling out there that the non-sedating antihistamines don't work quite as, aren't quite as effective antihistaminically as the sedating antihistamines are. But I'm not sure that I've seen any studies that show that's really true. Hmm. Okay. I think it's like any other medication. Some people love one and some people love another.
All right. Let's talk again with caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have sort of a back-to-school question. I have teenagers in the house, and they like to stay up late, and I'm wondering how I'm ever going to get them up for school, since getting up early has been so hard. There's been some information out about their specific physiology says it's harder for them to get up, and they're telling me these things. But anyways, is there anything just other than trying to get them to bed a little bit earlier? They say they can't sleep if they go to bed at 10. So I just was curious if you had read anything or had any ideas medically what might help get the kids to bed early and up early.
I think basically you let their biologic clock shift over to school. To the school clock. I think our school clocks are a little bit unreasonable. I think they have been forever. But I think in the morning you just get them up and, you know, you rip the blankets off, you put cold water on them and that sort of stuff, and you just get them up, and then they'll be more tired and they'll be able to go to sleep earlier at night.
Okay, so no magic here.
No magic here. I'm not sure. You know, the studies that show, the studies that made the news, gosh, it was several months ago, show that teenagers would be best on, you know, not starting school till 11 o'clock in the morning, and they need 9 hours of sleep versus 8.5 hours of sleep for an adult and that sort of stuff. I'm not sure how good those studies, you know, I'm not sure what to make of those studies.
Okay.
I'm not sure I actually believe them, and you know, and I'm not sure what you're going to do about it anyway.
True. I just was wondering, you know, they used to say milk at night makes you sleepier,
yeah.
Or you know.
Yeah, but these kids have had all summer to get their clock shifted over to summer schedule, and they'll get their clocks shifted over to the school year schedule.
So just get them up and
Get them up and load them on the bus, and hopefully
and
you can sneak some breakfast
whining.
In. Don't listen to their, well, yeah.
What, you mean you listen to their whining any other time?
Oh, no. I just was kind of curious. I just wanted Dr. Bocek's opinion.
Yeah, so. You just yank the covers off and say it's time.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Again, I'll just say other questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. It's Children's Health here on Focus. It's something we do every month, always on a Thursday. So whatever questions that you have, you can give us a call.
School is starting in a couple of weeks, and the teenagers you're in trouble with, you know, you can't, yeah, you just rip their covers off and tell them it's time to get up in the morning, and 5 minutes later you go do it again because they probably pull their covers back up again. I think it's the first time to schoolers that you can honestly do something about, you can honestly prepare them. And, you know, you can start, yeah, I hope you've been talking up school all along so they're not afraid of, you know, and they don't have any disdain for school and that. But I think, again, teaching them how to cross the street, teaching them the way to school or the way to the bus stop, walking them there, you know, the first day or two of school or with registration, show them their classroom and that sort of stuff. If they're going to eat lunch in school, let them pick out their lunch boxes. If this is your first child going to school, you might talk to more veteran parents about, gee, what do kids wear in school and that sort of stuff, so the kids don't feel, you know, they feel a part of the school, they're wearing common clothes and that sort of stuff. The schools that have gone to uniforms, boy, I don't hear any complaints. I don't hear any complaints from the parents. I don't hear any complaints from the kids. That seems to work great. The parents enjoy that because they know exactly what to buy. And the kids, and yeah, there's no fights in the morning about what color we're going to wear and that sort of stuff, but I think do start getting your kids ready to school. Make sure that they have the necessary supplies so they aren't short when you get to school, and start getting them ready. We've got a couple weeks left, I think. A couple weeks left, and I don't have to do any more school physicals.
It'll be here before you know it. Okay, let's go on here. We have another caller, and let me just pull up my screen here. And it's someone on a car phone, so we'll get right there. Line number one. Hello?
Hello. Talking about going back to school, it seems like every time we go back to school, we hear about lice. And the last time my kids got it, we got that, not my kids, it was another kid who got the time that are immune to the RID. Is there anything else that can work just in case next time it's my kids that get it?
There's several products. Some over the counter, like RID and Nix, are over the counter. We have some prescription products we can use. And I think, you know, the biggest problem with head lice is who's making the diagnosis. Do they really have them? I mean, if you see the live bugs in their hair, they've got active head lice. They need treatment. If you see these little funny things on the hair shaft, are those nits? Or are they more likely to be dead skin cells, keratin plugs coming off with them? And I think and the other thing, there was a study, one or two studies published recently where they sent samples of what people thought were lice to experts in lice. And what they found out was 90% of these things weren't lice or nits in the first place. So I think we've got, and to the best of my knowledge too, head lice, outside of being creepy and making you feel negligent and unhygienic, do not transmit any disease. And indeed, it has nothing to do with hygiene. It has something to do with contagiousness. Some poor kid picks up lice, and then they share a hat or something with other people, and the lice spread. The other thing that probably our schools do that is probably ridiculous is a nit-free policy. Your child, after head lice, can't come back to school till the nits are gone. Because most of the treatments we use are ovicidal, that is, they will kill the nits, and getting nits out of hair is an impossible job.
Oh, no.
The most effective way to do it is with a nit comb, a very fine comb, which is still very laborious. I mean, these nits are glued on tightly, and they just don't come out easily. And little girls cry and little boys cry when you try and comb them free. And I'm not the studies out on vinegar and some of the stuff that's supposed to loosen the nits are not particularly good. Yeah, nothing. There's no magic about getting these nits off.
Okay. Well, the last time my kids got it, I simply shaved my boy's hair.
That works.
But since my friend got the ones, they actually caught a nit and dropped it in a puddle of RID, and the thing swam around.
Okay, so that wasn't a nit. That was a live critter. That was an adult.
They got a nit, the critter, and they put it in the shampoo that was supposed to kill them.
Okay.
It swam around, and so they figured they had the resistant one, and I was wondering if we happen to pick up the resistant one.
Yeah, then
anything we can do.
Yeah, try RID, try Nix. If that doesn't work, call your doctor's office, and there's some prescription insecticides that we've got.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Just now it occurs to me, going back to something that we probably talked about this a zillion times, but again, I think it's been discussed some in the news, and that is the issue of meningitis.
Okay.
As now, again, here where it is a concern for parents who have older kids who are going back to school, that again, from time to time, we see this problem where we have meningitis outbreaks and at universities. And it seems to have a lot to do with the fact that in their social life and outside of the classroom, it's either in dormitories or apartments or going out to bars or stuff. People are really crowded together, and this facilitates transmission of something like meningitis. And the question is, and I've asked you this question before, that now parents are having to confront is, well, should I have my child vaccinated before they go back to college? And this is something that there seems to be a big controversy about. Yeah. Some people say yes. Some people say, you know, it's just not worth it, particularly if you kind of understand the etiology of the whole thing is you can avoid it, and that the vaccine is really not necessary. And anything that you've heard lately that has changed the way you think about this?
No. I'm waiting for the new vaccine. Yeah, the problem with Neisseria meningitidis, and that's what we're talking about, the kind of meningitis we're talking about, is there's three or four strains of it. I think two are the most common. We don't have a particularly good vaccine in the United States. There's a better vaccine in Europe. Hasn't been licensed in this country yet. Hopefully it'll come soon. So why don't we give the vaccine that we've got now that's not that great a vaccine and give the new one when it comes out? The problem is you don't get a booster response. You lose, the titers go down, so you lose protection that way. We are talking about a very rare infection. I think we're talking about 1,400 deaths a year in the entire United States. So we are talking about a quite rare infection. The vaccine, most of the colleges and universities are recommending it. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and the AAP are not routinely recommending it. I think my recommendation is wait, be the first one in line if there's an outbreak on campus. But an outbreak is not a single case unless it happens to be in the kid who lives in the room, your roommate or the kid who lives in the next room over. College students, stay out of the bars. Anyway, for other reasons.
Dr. Bojack says stay out of the bar.
But I think my official recommendation is I'm not hot on the vaccine out there. From the data I'm aware of, I'm not hot on the vaccine currently recommended. If you're really nervous about it, go ahead and do it. I think we have more to worry about. Bike helmets and seat belts, I think, would save a whole lot more lives than this vaccine, and stay out of the bars for a whole variety of reasons.
All right. About 10 minutes left. Dr. Robert Bojack is our guest. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic. That's our monthly show on children's health. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Urbana is next. Line one. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Bojack. We just found out that my 18-year-old daughter has a weird condition, and I was hoping you could explain a little to me. I doubt that it would be of relevance to anybody else, but she has something called, situs inversus?
Situs inversus, okay. She's just backwards. She's just backwards. Everything's rotated.
Is that very common?
No, and I don't know the exact numbers. It's not very common. It's generally associated with nothing, as long as you're a true situs inversus. Your heart's backward, lungs backward, intestines are backwards. You just everything's backwards. There's no problems.
Was heart and stomach?
Yeah,
on the opposite.
Yeah,
side.
Then she's probably a total situs inversus, and that's associated with nothing. If just the heart's reversed, that's sometimes associated with congenital heart disease and that, and the situs inversus are often found accidentally. They go in for a respiratory infection, get a chest X-ray, and you flip up the heart, you flip up the chest X-ray, you rotate it, and you say, and the left marker's on the wrong side. And you find out accidentally because it's really of no health significance.
Mm-hmm. But it would have been that way all the time then, right? It's not like some...
She was born that way and will die that way.
Uh-huh.
And live to a ripe old age. Yeah, it won't have any effect.
It's just that she should let doctors or whatever know before they start cutting her open or they decide to shock her or something.
Yeah.
Does she wear like a med alert bracelet for that?
No, it's not necessary. And if she needs cardioversion, it doesn't matter either where you put the paddles particularly.
But somebody was saying, I guess they told her that not only is it like on the other side, but it's sort of turned around.
Yeah, it's everything's backwards. Everything's flipped around. She's the mirror image of what most people are.
Oh, wow.
Inside. But again, it's of no clinical significance. It just drives us nuts because we can't figure out how to put the X-ray up on the viewing board. And did the X-ray tech put the left marker on the left side, or did?
Well, they made her take the X-ray over because they said something must be wrong with it, or we must have done it wrong, or.
Because we always hang a film with the apex of the heart on the right side. And the left marker's supposed to be on the right side the way we hang it, and if it's on the other side, you say, "Wait a minute."
Okay, well, thanks.
You're
okay.
Welcome.
Nothing to worry about. Then.
Nothing to worry about.
Okay.
Very good. Let's go on here. Another local person. This is Champagne, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering, my son, he's 15 years old. He's a sophomore. He played football last year and year before last, and this year he didn't want to play. But he decided he wanted to do cross country instead, but that doesn't start until the spring, and I was just wondering if springtime comes around, he decides he really doesn't want to do that, you know, if we should, you know, have him do it anyways, because he's not, I mean, he skateboards.
Okay.
But, you know, other than that, you know, his physical activity is kind of slim.
Computer games.
Oh.
And the TV remote.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we're a society that, the fitter getting fitter and the fatter getting fatter.
Yeah.
I have a great deal of difficulty recommending making him go out for a sport.
Even though he said he would do it. And
yeah, because you know what? If he decides he's not going to do it, he's not going to do it.
Uh-huh.
Actually, you know what? Cross country is a fall sport. So he already says, I'm not going out for cross country because it's a fall sport. It's going on now.
Oh, well, I'm...
Track's a spring sport.
Oh.
So maybe he wants to go out for track.
Oh, wow. Okay. All righty. And real quickly, how important is breakfast for a 15-year-old son, boy? I mean, is cereal and milk okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't feel so bad then.
But breakfast is, we think breakfast is an important meal that it kind of sets up your appetite for the rest of the day, tends to clean up your diet. You know, you're less hungry, so your other meals are a little bit smaller. You tend to eat less junk food, you know, less of the potato chips and the high calorie, low nutrient things, but a bowl of cereal's fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
All You're right, welcome.
Thank you. And we have someone else here calling from a car phone, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a 3-year-old son, and my question is about at what point allergy testing is a useful activity. He has lots of congestion, lots of times, and I think he got some genetic bad screws put to him by me. I have allergies to many things.
Okay.
So the point would be... doing it too early was not recommended, but at what point do we start investigating allergies?
Yeah. Rule of thumb is probably skin testing should be avoided till after age 5 because you don't get very good results with it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't tend to react. You don't get very good information out of skin testing at that age. The other thing, the 3-year-old in daycare,
only part-time.
Okay. Well, part-time's good enough to catch a lot of infections. And I think if these symptoms are intermittent rather than chronic, you know, last a week or two, and then there's definitely a well point for several weeks, it's more likely to be infectious.
Mm-hmm.
An upper respiratory infection than allergies.
Any danger of continuous Sudafed in the nighttime to get him to be able to breathe to go to sleep?
No.
Okay.
No, not that we know of.
Because he has a hard time with congestion and wakes himself up, you know, not being able to breathe.
Yeah.
So try not to load him up with too much stuff, but at the same time, if he's not breathing, well, he's not going to sleep.
Yeah, enough stuff to keep him comfortable and facilitate normal body functions and sleep patterns and that.
Well, he's never had normal sleep patterns.
Okay.
He's doing pretty well.
Yeah, what are normal sleep patterns? I don't know.
I don't either. What typically happens is he'll get some congestion, and then it seems to turn into a cold, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of lingers and lingers and lingers, and drainage changes colors and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is infection. However, knowing my history and so forth.
You're waiting for it.
Well, yeah, I think he's going to have it. But I don't want to talk him into it either.
No.
That's it. Thank you.
You're
okay.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, normal sleep pattern. You know, the baby's supposed to sleep through the night by 6 to 8 weeks of age and not supposed to wake up till morning. But one study I'm aware of, there is a minority that won't fit into that sleep pattern. The size of the majority is 33%. Something like a third of the kids will wake up at least once a night through age 5. And as I recall from this study, maybe longer than that, but that's when the study, that's when they quit looking and the study ended. So it is not abnormal at all for kids not to have normal sleep pattern, or abnormal is normal.
One, we'll try to do one more. Champagne, line 2. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Bocek. It's been a long time since I talked to you. The reason I'm calling is I just wanted to make sure that my children are safe in that they're Eurasian. I'm European. My husband's Japanese, so we live in Japan, and we also live in America. We were in Japan for 5 years, and we've just come back to this area. And I finally found out my children's blood types. And one of them is A negative, and another one is O negative. And a general practitioner in Japan said to me, sort of jokingly, well, you better make sure that they don't have any serious injuries because those blood types are rare here. And so I didn't think it was very funny. But I would assume that they're easily available here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, every once in a while you hear on TV or something that, you know, blood donations have been poor this month because everybody's doing something or other. But, yeah, if your children transfusions are rarely needed anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But if your kids are in a serious accident and need a transfusion, I'm sure it'll be there.
Mm-hmm. So there's a wider range available.
Yeah, and the blood banks would sure like to get a hold of them.
Would they really? Well, they're too. I suppose they're too young to give blood, though. My oldest is 14. He's bigger than I am, though. He weighs more than I do.
Yeah.
So
I can't remember the age rules.
Well, he is bigger than I am. They might.
But within the next year or so, I'm sure they'd be glad to take his blood.
Oh, really? Great. Well, I'll send them over. They can have as much as they want.
They can have a quart or something.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, I guess we're maybe about the point where we'll wrap up for this time around with the promise that next month, Dr. Bocek will be back and we'll be doing it again. Any last thought you'd like to leave with folks?
And kids out there, enjoy the last 2 weeks of vacation. I'm looking forward to the last school physical coming up pretty soon.
All right. Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician at Christie Clinic in Champaign. He's with us every month on Thursday for the shows on children's health.